Good afternoon and welcome to another edition of El Paso Primetime, a production of KTEP. This encore presentation was first aired April 10th, 2010.
The problem with communication is the illusion that it has occurred. George Bernard Shaw. I'm Florence Schwein, your El Paso Primetime host, and today my guest is an associate professor of communication and an adjunct professor in the College of Health Sciences here at UTEP. Dr. Samuel Russillo researches the role of the human communication system in the neurosocial evolution of the brain. He has also been working with professors in the College of Engineering on a project dealing with classroom learning. Sam, it's a real pleasure for me to have you on El Paso Primetime. Welcome back.
Florence, it's a pleasure to be here.
To effectively communicate, the speaker and the receiver have to essentially agree on the message. This agreement, or communication, is at the root of learning from infancy through our elder years. Let's just step back to childhood. Wouldn't that be fun?
Well, in some cases.
Many of our listeners probably remember being sent out to play after school and told to come home at supper time. Why was that so important for us, and why is it necessary for children to do just kid kinds of things?
I think kids kinds of things are very important in a variety of ways. In developing brains, for example, I think that the more opportunity kids have to express themselves and to participate in discovery, it's very critical. I think even in terms of most of the five senses, the kinds of things that you get by playing in the dirt, climbing walls, a variety of things are strategically important for human knowledge.
And it also increases imagination, too.
Oh, I think it has a tremendous effect there as well, because imagination comes from the fact that you have an experience with something real, and then you can anticipate or change or alter, and it gives you all kinds of strange outcomes.
Oh, I remember playing in a sandbox before I went to school. And making all sorts of fancy dishes.
Oh, I'll bet, yes.
With twigs.
Twigs. And having like somebody eat them as well.
Well, I probably ate a little bit of the sand in the process, but no, I loved it. There was a locust tree, I think, over the sandbox. Bad place to have
one. Oh, I'm sure, yes.
But, and it wasn't in the desert. It was in the Midwest. Well, now youngsters spend many hours being passive TV viewers, text messaging, and being masters of the keyboard. Are there dangers when those activities are not balanced with other activities?
My concern with regard to technologizing the word, and that's basically what we're talking about, is the fact that the subject becomes nothing but a receiver. And we have a principle in social neuro operations of language in the brain, and we call it a thing that was really created by Vygotsky over 100 years ago on inner speech, okay, speech for the self.
So that speech that goes through our mind,
right.
Not necessarily verbal.
Right. Some of it can be verbal. Some of it can be in a variety of ways. We're not sure entirely all of them. But once you become accustomed to only participating in a conversation with yourself, you become remarkably restrictive and probably less able to function in a variety of different kinds of contexts dealing with people.
So maybe sometimes it's okay to talk to yourself?
I think that's the most significant thing in the world. Going back again to a man that I rever, a man by the name of Lev Semenovich Vygotsky, who lived in the 30s in Russia, he talked about the notion of talk to the self. Most of my theoretical perspective comes from that, because when you talk to yourself, okay, you also listen. And you also can discover some arrangement of how you're putting things together in the universe, which helps you clarify for the most part, helps you categorize for the most part, but it's an incomplete one.
But it's important when we talk to ourselves to be careful what kind of message we're giving ourselves, I think.
Well, let me put it this way. We're our most enchanted listeners.
Oh, okay. and this is the patient. Whole,
yes, because what you do is you cut out the social dimension. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons that we have speech as a form of communication is to engage with others. And that helps you clarify your position, your thinking, your activity from other human beings. And if you're engaged with a continual internal conversation, it's remarkably restrictive.
I can see that. Well, if we go back, we say that human infants learn that by their actions, they can alter their world. And then as preschoolers, we develop language, but it's in grammar school that we really begin to be problem solvers. And by middle school, we begin to understand abstract concepts. Am I on the right track here?
Yes. One of the interesting things, I was thinking about the Christian orientation in the Roman Church that says that you really can't be responsible for your sins until you reach the age of reason, right?
Not so.
but generally speaking, what they're talking about is about the seventh year, the cognitive capacity to see right from wrong, for example, begins to really truly emerge rather than just as a restrictive thing imposed by parents and other siblings. And this capacity to reason gets expanded. Now, what becomes critically important during the developmental years is how much input you place on the part of the student. Now, let's take, for example, just a mathematical notion of adding and subtracting, for example. And you look at these relationships in a very clear kinds of perspectives. What you're asking the organism to do, a child in this case, is to arrange something in a rather distinct formal system, right? Addition in any system asks you to quantify, right, in a way that you increase the value of something or you decrease the value of something. And these are very interesting kinds of things. Piaget, for example, talked about laws of conservation in very early childhood, okay, where you could take two glasses of water and place them on the table, one glass being very large and the other being very small, but holding the exact same amounts of water, and the child can make a clear distinction between the two and usually picks the larger container, okay, as an example. Well, as you begin to teach folks, and children in particular, what you do is you then assign certain criteria, what we call cognitive expectations, that can allow them to solve problems and draw conclusions that are accurate.
Piaget, I think, had four stages of learning at that time period.
Yes.
And have we expanded on that?
No, it seems to be pretty much within the same realm when I was looking at developmental notions. I tend to steer more with the Russian orientation that was developed by Vygotsky and then, of course, later developed by Sokolov and others. And I was fortunate enough to meet and talk with Sokolov on a couple of occasions as I would leave here in the summer and spend time at Virginia Tech with an old colleague of mine. We would talk about what kinds of developmental systems would be best illustrative of these kinds of things and then write the cognitive model for it, okay, mm-hmm. in terms of what would the child have to hear. In Vygotsky's theory, he had a thing called latitude of acceptance of certain kinds of notions, and he talked about the various kinds of people who trigger those. They could be peers, right? You give some comment to a peer, right, about how big your father is compared to his father and so on down the line. But as you do these particular kinds of things, you begin to notice that the comparisons start to be made and the person gets a better orientation to what we will later call an objective world.
And when we reach that age of reason, do we also gain empathy at that time period?
I think,
and that's part of talking back and forth to yourself.
I think empathy, if you're talking about it in terms of a communication process, you're pretty egocentric till you're about six or seven. And then you have periods of going back and forth.
I know some egocentric people now.
Yes. And I think this is one of the things that really tends to be the result of the technology age. This is the one I'm most disturbed about at the moment because you become involved strictly within a message system where you are a consumer and there's no interaction. There's no discussion, for example. There's no clarification. You begin to think that the technology you're watching is going to be perfectly accurate each time.
And it's not always.
No.
If you are just joining us, you are listening to El Paso Primetime, and I'm Florence Schwein interviewing Dr. Samuel Russillo, Associate Professor, UTEP's Communication Department. We've been talking about learning and communication. Sam, as college students or young adults, the learning tasks involve complex abstract concepts. You are actually looking at classroom learning and working with people in our College of Engineering. Please tell us about that CCLI
grant from the National Science Foundation. Mm-hmm. That involves two very close colleagues of mine. Arun Penather is the principal investigator, and Lewis Everett is a co-principal investigator like myself in that project. Mm-hmm. What we're looking at in that project is really quite unique because as we're looking at the learning process, one of the things that's never been examined and that we got, you know, 3 years of support to begin examining is the planning process. So what we're doing very carefully is designing a system where we're interviewing colleagues at not only UTEP but at 9 other institutions across the country and asking them what they actually do in the process of planning. So we say, for example, if you have an objective for a course, how might you consider providing an experience, an activity, demonstration, whatever it might be, for that particular objective, and trying to develop, from my perspective, a cognitive model. That is, what is the thinking process like going from something that is very specific, like, say, this bottle of water, to something very abstract like the conservation of water? Okay, so going from low-level abstraction to high-level abstraction is really dependent upon how well that teacher organizes a class. So we're looking at how they have thought about it. For example, the people we interview with certain kinds of engineering strategies may be, or have been for the most part, both people who have been in industry for mm-hmm. a while, as well as coming back to the academy to begin the process of training future engineers.
It's almost something that I think about a lot, and a teacher is basically a facilitator. So if you're presenting material to where the student kind of does a aha for the next step,
yes,
then you can meet what your outcomes are supposed to be or you want them to be.
Well, you want that participation. And one of the things that I think we can certainly look at the models of learning, okay, that are present in terms of educational and pedagogical theories. But actual learning, for example, in terms of going from the, say, the handling of this this particular bottle to, aha, I now know why they put it in this bottle or why they store it or why they call it potable water, right, kind of thing, is a very intriguing process. A lot of students can be exposed to the same process where some will get it and some won't get it. So you have to figure out what was it in the process, okay, in terms of exploring this high-level abstraction that the student didn't make the leap from the bottle itself and the water, right, to maybe potable water, storage of water, conservation of water, all the high levels of abstraction. So we try to look at those particular processes. Again, we're looking at a model, again, of cognitive operations. We know that if you can put something at the level of hands-on, okay, kind of thing. Like one of the things we're learning from interviewing many of these professors, they have thought about this at, you know, rather unique depths. And so they have all these little games to interact with the student so that when they can handle it, feel it, move it, manipulate it, then all of a sudden they will get this aha. Okay, now I see what you mean, and now this is what this equation is all about. An equation is very high-level abstraction, right, about all of the observations that are taken into account when one uses all of the available means of acquiring information about something.
So in order to do this kind of research, you have to come up with a protocol, basically.
Yes, and when we're going into this area, the protocol that we're looking at primarily right now is trying to examine especially when professors talk, okay, what their what their thinking process is like. Okay, so what we do is we record long extended interviews with these folks where we're asking them large numbers of questions about the process. And then we form category systems, okay, in terms of what kinds of plans that they use to do this with, what kinds of innovative structures they might want to employ in it. Do they use classroom observations with it? Do they use lectures with it? And one of the intriguing things that I saw the other day and really hadn't thought about it till this professor was talking to us about using the blackboard.
Oh.
Okay. I mean, everybody else was talking to us about, you know, PowerPoint, you know. And one of the things that he observed was that in the PowerPoint demonstrations, studying the same thing, right, a particular theoretical area they were covering, is that the students couldn't follow it. But when he did it on the board and went through the equation step by step, they were with him the whole way. So we examined the notes, for example, from the students, and they were all present in terms of where he was at when it was blackboard, but they lost him in the PowerPoint presentation.
Did they have anything to do with the time that was taking place where he was writing things on the blackboard as opposed to flipping on the PowerPoint?
Yeah, I think what happens here, when you get to the blackboard to run an equation and you have to do everything, you know, that on the blackboard as you're drawing or writing it out and so on, the students had the opportunity to synchronize.
Have okay, that time.
Yes, synchronize with the activity that the person was trying to use to explain the equation.
I think that's amazing. Yeah. I can remember a math professor who turned his back to the students and just wrote and wrote and wrote.
We thought he was. Yes. Yes.
He was having a great time. And
you were suffering.
Right. We were suffering. That was a long time ago in college. Dr. Russillo is also the director of the Biosemiotic Research Laboratory, where he examines the relationship between speech and thought. I understand that some of your work deals with a frustration theory, and you have done some research for the Army.
Yes. We have been fortunate. The Army Research Laboratories has been very good to us over the years in terms of building our laboratory in biosemiotics. Our laboratory consists of EEGs, electroencephalograms, okay, measurements of the brain, as well as ERPs if we analyze them further, heart rate, galvanic skin response, respiration rates. We can measure a variety of indicators of what's going on in the person when we're concerned about a particular phenomenon. Now, one of the things that I had done for them when they were the division I was working with was survivability and lethality. And what they were concerned was what about frustration? Okay, you hear this constantly, people are being frustrated. Well, frustration is a very old theory in psychology. It goes back to the late 19th century, early 20th century. It's on a continuum generally in their theoretical perspective from frustration to aggression.
Okay. Uh-oh.
So if you can't control your frustration, you're going to be remarkably aggressive. Kind of.
This sounds like something we all need to know about here.
Well, no one has ever done the brain imaging in terms of EEG and mapping the areas of the brain and other areas simultaneously with frustration. So we took frustration and we said, all right, let's take something that these students – because we're going to use them as subjects, right? We had to draw from the population. So we did three groups of subjects, the ROTC class 1 year, an engineering group the second year. Now we're working on a third one right now of just the average student, okay, going across the area. And we would measure and construct this little game called a circle game, P-square mm-hmm. circle game. And it's just a normal thing when the circles converge, right? You make a click and you don't let them converge. Well, we changed it just a little bit. Uh-oh. So that there would be 2 milliseconds, right, that mm-hmm. you had to focus on to hit before the circles converged to be right. And if you let it go beyond that, you would be wrong. And so we trained them.
That yeah. would be a task.
Very so. But these kids, you know, with they're playing with games and stuff, this is all secondhand to them, right? So we trained them on numerous trials. And as they went through this process, which was interesting, they acquired learning ability. They were good at it. We would slow it down for them. We said, no, don't slow it down. We know exactly we can do this, you know. So we set up a testing situation that they didn't know about. little deception involved in here. We had 400 trials that we were going to work on. The first 100 trials, they were totally on their own, right? They were almost perfect.
Uh-oh.
Every subject was perfect, right? Hitting it at the right time. Well, unbeknownst to them, in the second trial, 20 of those trials, right, no matter what they did, they'd be wrong. Okay, so on the screen, the
wrong. And they couldn't understand that.
But they kept clicking, right? Mm-hmm. The third trial was random, that every half of them would be right, half of them would be wrong kind of thing. And then the last trial was mainly you're going to be wrong 80% of the time. Now, what's intriguing about this is that none of the students gave up. They went through every testing situation, clicked 400 times, okay?
And they just kept at it?
Just kept at it.
Their fingers were just flying?
No, they were convinced they could do it, right, kind of thing, and they were not going to give that up. Okay, they were not going to be dealing with it. 85% said they were frustrated, right, but they would not give it up. And that's what's intriguing to us, because that's given us a new theory that maybe the real goal that we should be dealing with in frustration theory is frustration tolerance. That is how to deal with tolerance of frustration and then anticipate changes so you can work on them in terms of making changes and getting out of frustrating situations. You don't want, for example, people pushing the wrong buttons at the wrong time simply for the sake of pushing buttons. So frustration is a very intriguing thing. The goal is thwarted. The person becomes, and we can see it in the brain, because we image this in the brain, and high emotional areas. Once we got past the second and third trials, the frontal area of the cortex was totally lit up in red, which means high level of frustration.
So, but for the Army, it seems like part of their concern would be trying to identify an enemy, and then how do you deal with that when you can't identify the enemy. You don't know who that enemy is.
One of the things they're going to have to probably do from the base data or the basic research that we did is perhaps change training policies. Today, wars are fought with common people. Mm-hmm. And so what you're dealing with today is all these people are dressed alike. You're the only one in the uniform if you're a U.S. Soldier, you know.
So you're identifiable.
In Iraq in Afghanistan. So you're immediately identified, okay? But you're walking down a street and all of a sudden somebody comes out of the corner with the same kind of dress, right, as you've been talking to, the same kind of face, all these sorts of things, and they have an AK-47 or they have a bomb attached to them or whatever. And you have to be very prudent in the exercise of judgment as to whether or not you fire, what action you take altogether. So the Army is looking through things like that.
So you have to not only have the ability to make judgments, but also snap decisions.
Snap decisions and also deal with the issue of frustration. You could be totally wrong.
Right.
Yeah.
And that just stays with you. Sam, you're also an adjunct professor in the College of Health Sciences in one of its laboratories. Would you share that with us?
Yes. Dr. Salvatore and I helped build a laboratory over there with very similar processes that we use in the biosemiotic laboratory. We deal mainly with EEG and respiration rates for subjects. And we work in that laboratory primarily because we're concerned about the kinds of problems that occur when people get or have injuries to the head. Okay, in this case, most of the people that we're dealing with over there would be aphasic, have difficulty speaking or difficulty hearing. And that's what I've been dealing with in terms of writing the protocols for assessment of brain damaged individuals.
That's so interesting, and it's really important in this day and age where we have so many things that happen to individuals along the way.
Yeah, see, at this point, Dr. Salvatore is off in another area also called brain concussion, and he's looking now to develop different protocols to assess what happens in the brain, because I don't think we realize what happens even being shook up. But concussion primarily for sports and athletes for the most part. But we're also discovering, or he's discovering, I should say, from examining soldiers at Fort Bliss, that if they've been in explosions of one kind or another, their heads suffer concussion effects. That is, there are arteries that break. And there's damage to various parts of the brain, which slow or moderate their cognitive capacity.
It seems to me that there's been tremendous advancement in the studies of the brain in the last decade or two. What does all this mean for seniors out there in primetime radio land?
Well, what I have to say to seniors is what I started before, that, you know, neurons that fire together, right? Are certainly programmed together. They become circuits of their own.
So and what are you really telling us when you use that phrase? It's a catchy one. Neurons that fire together are wired together.
Yes. The catchy phrase is this, is that don't stop doing what you're doing. Okay. One of the things I think that keeps the brain alive, just like doing exercise every day in terms of walking, I would certainly spend as much time as I could involved in conversation with people. I would certainly spend a good deal of time reading. And engaging in conversation, I think, is probably the more critical one, because it helps you gauge and become less egocentric. Sometimes people give up. Okay, kind of thing. And this is kind of extraordinary, but the brain needs to be exercised on a regular basis. And that means activity which allows the person to talk and interact with other human beings. And I think that's critical.
Well, I guarantee that seniors know something about frustration, stress, and health issues. As the years speed by, what's happening in the aging brain that's normal?
What's happening in the aging brain is that the process is slowing to some degree, just like you don't run a 50-yard dash in 4.9 seconds when you're 80 years old. There's just no way to do it. But you can run 50 yards, okay? So I would go through the exercise of it. And in the brain, what you have is a slowing of the process. For example, if we took an EEG from, say, someone who is 25 or 30 years of age and compared it to someone who is 60 to 70 years of age, you will see the waveform activity in terms of electrical activity diminishing to somewhat. But it is still firing.
But we just need to learn patience with ourselves.
Yes, and
maybe that's one of the best lessons.
Well, I think so, because one that gets us in trouble is this issue of memory, right?
Right. Oh, now, what was that?
Exactly.
I can't recall that name.
Yeah, there you go. And I have trouble with those things, too, as everyone else does. And so what you do, if you relax for a few minutes, all of a sudden the connection is made.
Oh, right. If you go do something else and come back, you can say
yes, exactly. So, you know, don't take it out on yourself. Simply say, I forgot at the moment, but it'll return shortly.
Have that conversation with yourself.
There you go.
This one is one that you
Absolutely.
Should be having. Dr. Samuel Russillo, this has just been fascinating. You reminded us of the importance of effective communication in all of life stages, and especially clued us in on communication skills for seniors. Thank you so much for your expertise and time. To listen to this and another interview with Dr. Samuel Russillo, go to ktep.org. Click on Past Programs in the upper left corner and scroll down to Primetime, formerly Senior Junction, and you'll be able to hear them. My thanks to you, Sam, and my thanks to Dennis Wu, our producer, for making our audio communication effective. I'm Florence Schwein for El Paso Primetime.
Since its initial airing on April 10, 2010, Dr. Sam Russillo has since retired from the University of Texas at El Paso, is now a professor emeritus. El Paso Primetime is recorded and produced at the KTEP studios on the University of Texas at El Paso campus. All rights reserved 2010 by KTEP, UT El Paso, and the UT Board of Regents. No portion of any program broadcast on KTEP may be used without the express written consent by KTEP management. Join us again next week for El Paso Primetime. Have a great week. I'll be happy.